Today's Teisho will be on Case 38 in the Book of Serenity. Case 38 is entitled Linji's True Person. Introduction: taking a thief for one's son, taking a servant for the master, can a broken wooden ladle be your ancestor's skull? A donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone either. When breaking earth, separating reeds, how do you discern the master? Linji said to the assembly, there is a true person of no rank, always going in and out through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet witnessed it, look, look. Then a monk came forward and said, what is this person of no rank? Linji got down from the seat, grabbed him and held him. The monk hesitated. Linji pushed him away and said, the true person of no rank. What a piece of dry crap he is. Verse, delusion and enlightenment are opposite, subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. It's hopeless. The mud and sand can't be cleared away, clearly blocking off the eye of the sweet spring. If suddenly it burst forth, it would flow freely. So thank you all very much for coming to practice. And some of you have been sitting here since very early in the morning. And as you know, we do 3 periods of meditation in the morning at our session, and it's a long stretch. You have an hour and a half of sitting, and it's very challenging, especially today for those of us who started on Tuesday night. It's now, the fourth day of the session, and your legs get tired, and that hour and a half is really challenging. It's a wonderful opportunity, though, to get into deeper concentration, but it's challenging, and everybody sat so well this morning, so still. I really thank you for making such an excellent effort. So this is a famous koan that you may or may not have heard of. Linji's true person of no rank. Let me put this in context. We talked yesterday about the first koan in this collection. I mentioned that this collection, the Book of Serenity, is a little different from the Mumon Kan and the Blue Rock collection. Those are the Gate of No Barrier and the Blue Rock collection are, you could say, textbooks, Zen textbooks. That's what they were written to be. And this also is a Zen textbook, the Book of Serenity. And it was often used in the training of people in the Soto tradition. The Soto tradition is one of the 2 branches of Zen. Originally, there were 5 branches of Zen. They were said to be 5 houses of Zen. And that means that there were 5 lineages of teaching that came down from basically Wei Neng, you could say. And many of those, 3 of those houses more or less became inactive. So the 2 surviving lineages of Zen were the Linji lineage and the Soto, the Sao Tong lineage. And on the other hand, the other lineages were very vibrant and interesting and creative, but for various reasons, they just didn't remain active in China. In the 20th century, the great Chinese Zen master Xu Yun actually set out to revive those three moribund schools, and he actually taught strategies or teaching techniques from the various Zens, the three Zen schools that had fallen into disuse. And he was said to be the heir to all of the five houses. So, you know, nothing's ever really gone. And there, if you do some research, you can see that some of these traditions in Zen had a lot of have a lot to offer even now. So, for example, in many of the koans, there's a Zen master named Yunmen, Cloud Gate Umong is what he's called in Japanese. And some of you might be working on a koan with Umong as the main figure right now. So, for example, what will happen when the last leaf has fallen off the tree? And Umong said, golden wind or golden breeze. That's an Umong koan. And there's a lot of Umong koans in both the Mumong Kan and the Blue Rock collection. But, you know, the Yunmen lineage didn't persist into the modern age for who knows why. It's interesting that Joshu had his own lineage and that didn't persist into the modern world. But luckily, Linji and Sao Tong persisted. And this is really like a Soto textbook full of training koans for monks and nuns and lay people. But interestingly, Linji shows up here. And I think it's a good argument for never making too much about these distinctions of between the different Zen schools, which are really just differences of strategy, really. The goal is to produce people who wake up. And the differences between Soto and Rinzai are really unimportant, in my opinion. People make too much of that. You know? And the fact is that here in the Soto textbook, here's Linji playing a role. And the founders of the two schools in China, the Linji school and the Sao Tong school, were good friends. You know, they actually had good relationships. So one of the interesting things about this book I mentioned yesterday was that, you know, the Mumong Kan and the Pien Lu, the Blue Rock Collection, both start with emptiness. In the case of the Mumong Kan, the book starts out with the koan, does a dog have Buddha nature? So a monk asks Joshu, does a dog have Buddha nature? And Joshu says, mu. He says, mu, or shunyata. So the monk says to Joshu, basically a philosophical question, you know, Buddha nature, do animals have Buddha nature? We know that humans do, but do animals have Buddha nature? And Joshu could have said, well, of course, according to the teachings, all sentient beings have Buddha nature. He could have said that. But if he had said that to the monk, he had said, of course, all sentient beings have Buddha nature because Buddha nature is inherent in sentience, in consciousness itself. The monk would have had a good answer, but he wouldn't understand what enlightenment was all about. He wouldn't understand. The answer would be an intellectually satisfying answer, but it wouldn't help him on his path to enlightenment. So instead of giving him an intellectual answer, Joshu points to the gate to enlightenment, which is emptiness. So when the student says, the monk says, does a dog have Buddha nature? Joshu says, just me. And, you know, this is maybe a beginning monk. He might have thought, well, why didn't he answer my question? Why did he say mu? You know, why did he say emptiness? What's that all about? But eventually, if he went back to his cushion and he sat down and he began to say mu, he would notice that his mind began to fall into this state of emptiness. It began to automatically go to this place where everything is blank, temporarily. And if you go there and you remain there for some time, you begin to have a deeper and deeper experience of emptiness, of shunyata, of mu-shin, we say. So that's the beginning of the mu-mon-kan. And a little earlier in the week, we looked at the first koan in the Blue Rock Collection, the Heikigan Roku, or Pienlu. And in the Pienlu, it talks about Bodhidharma going to meet Emperor Wu of Liang, and Emperor Wu of Liang asks him about the holy path. And Bodhidharma says, basically, enlightenment has nothing to do with holiness. It has to do with great, vast emptiness, vast emptiness. So the Emperor Wu of Liang is thinking in terms of worldly terms, you could say, in terms of good and bad, sacred and profane, pure and impure. And the emperor is thinking that if he does good deeds, he will reach enlightenment. If he does bad deeds, he will be impaired from his progress towards enlightenment. And Bodhidharma knows that if the emperor keeps thinking this way, he'll never be able to wake up. So instead of saying, yes, please do good deeds and clear away your karma, Bodhidharma shows him how to clear away his karma. He says, cultivate a mind of vast emptiness. And indeed, if we do meditation and we do notice that those empty spaces in our mind, you know, eventually they stop being brief intervals and they become bigger and bigger. So, you know, the first time you experience emptiness, it's like a little finger snap. It's just a moment, just a glance. But, you know, if you keep meditating on emptiness, eventually it becomes this vast ocean. It's just like this ocean of emptiness. And that's what Bodhidharma, what Dhammo, was pointing to when he said vast emptiness. And I said also that one of the interesting things about this koan collection is that it doesn't start with emptiness. Emptiness is like number two in the book. So number two in the book actually is Bodhidharma talking to the Emperor Wu of Liang, just like in the Blue Rock collection. But Emperor Wu is not the first koan here. The first koan is that the Buddha is sitting on his throne. And Manjushri says, everybody, hey, look at the Buddha. And then as soon as Manjushri says, behold, the Buddha, the world-honored one, the Buddha gets up from his seat and steps down and he gets down from his seat. So that's the koan. The Buddha sits on his throne. Manjushri announces that the Buddha is on his throne and the Buddha comes down. And we talked yesterday about how this is really about how it's necessary to take our practice into the world. It's necessary to take our practice into the world. And the thing is that it's possible to sit down on the cushion. Dasha will sit down on the cushion and learn how to enter a calm and serene place. And if you meditate for only a little while, like, you know, 2 or 3 months, You'll eventually be able to get into this calm and serene place, but you know what may happen to you is that you begin to notice that there's a discrepancy between the serenity you experience on the cushion and the lack of serenity you experience off the cushion. It's a very common experience, for example, to go to a sesshin. And, you know, many of us are now at day 4 of sesshin. And, you know, our minds are in a very different place from when we started. You know, if your mind is a little bit like my mind, I have significant intervals where I have very few thoughts. You know, this morning sitting on the cushion, my legs are a little sore, so, you know, I definitely was aware from time to time my legs were a little sore, you know. But on the other hand, when I looked at my mind, it was very clear, very, really empty almost, you know. There were intervals where very little thinking was going on, and my mind was clear and bright. You know, but what happens is people get into that state, and then, you know, they have a break, and they go outside, and if we're at Murray Grove, we walk along the flower beds and we look at the flowers. Probably yesterday you had a chance to go outside and walk around, and you're walking around outside. You're actually here in New Jersey. It's just been, oh, the sunlight is pouring in. You're walking around and you think, oh, why does everything seem so clear and so clean, right? So beautiful. And it's because we've been cleaning up our minds, right? Cleaning up our minds. So you know, basically this koan collection is saying it's not enough to cultivate emptiness. It's not enough to cultivate samadhi, mental stability. It's not even enough to cultivate advanced states of concentration on the cushion if you don't integrate that experience with your life, with your life. So that's really the setting for the koan that we're looking at today, the Linji koan. You know, Linji says, comes at this from maybe the opposite way. You know, Linji starts with the world outside sesshin. You know, he starts with the world outside the sesshin, but he's saying kind of the same thing, that these two things have to be integrated, that we have to integrate. And Linji was supposed to be this like phenomenal Zen practitioner. He only lived to be 51 years old, but in his brief life, he was hugely respected. You know, it's very interesting that in Chinese history, all of these great masters lived within a couple hundred years of each other. You know, it's really interesting. So, you know, basically, Nansen and Joshu, Nansen had met Hyakujo. You know, it's like all of these teachers were teaching all over China, and it was just like this extraordinary explosion of enlightenment. You know, people were deeply enlightened. People were all over the place in China in the Tang and Song dynasty because the whole culture believed in this, right? I mean, our culture is about making money. I don't think that's a secret, right? Our culture is about making money. And in the Tang dynasty, of course, there were always people who want to make money, but you know, the interesting thing was people respected the idea of enlightenment very highly. And, you know, all over China, there were public temples, just like public schools in America today. So there was this huge, just like in Tibet, you know, we all look at Tibet, but, you know, Tang Dynasty China was like Tibet. The whole society understood the importance of awakening as liberation from suffering, right? And so all over China, there's this explosion. There's Linji, there's Joshu, there's Yunmen, Umon, you know, all of these different teachers teaching. And Linji was particularly revered, you know, because he was very interested in this, in a way of teaching that brought these two things together in a special way, that the world on the cushion and the world off the cushion. And he starts with the world off the cushion, you know. Linji looks around and he sees a society where people have forgotten who they really are, what they really are. And I think it's a society very much like our society, right? I mean, a moment ago I said people in the Tang Dynasty really respected enlightenment. And there were definitely lots of people who were like that. But also, you know, the Tang Dynasty was a human society, just like any other society. There were lots of really power-hungry people who were willing to do terrible things. And, you know, people wasted their lives, you know, pursuing things that were trivial and unimportant. You know, I'll never forget. There was a person who came to sit with us, and she started sitting with us. This was maybe 15 years ago. She started sitting with us, and she started sitting really regularly. And I thought, you know, now here's somebody who really seems to be enjoying this. And then one day as she was leaving the Zendo, I stopped and said, you know, you're really making a lot of progress. You're sitting so well. And she looked at me and she said, yeah, I'm not going to keep doing this. She said, I'd rather just look at the internet in the morning. Really, that really happened. She said, I'd rather just get up and look at the internet, you know. I later learned she was not a very happy person, right? Somebody I knew filled me in on her very self-destructive behavior. And, you know, my image of her is somebody who was really quite lost in a kind of a labyrinth, right? You know, she had many self-destructive behaviors. She was deeply insecure. She was pursuing an academic career, and she was very ambitious. She was, you know, you meet a lot of people like this in the academic world who are very good at presenting publicly this wise and grounded persona, but who privately are very insecure people and very concerned about what other people think. You know, years ago, I was working with a graduate student, and she came into my office and she burst into tears. And the reason she was so upset, because one of her professors had criticized in the most offhanded way, had criticized something she said in class. She said something in class and the professor said, well, I don't think that's a very good idea, and then moved on. And I know the guy, he certainly didn't mean to hurt her feelings or run her down. But when she came into my office and started crying, she was devastated. You know, and she said, oh, that guy thinks I'm an idiot. He thinks I have no future in English. And it's like, I felt so moved, and I felt so, her suffering very acutely, because of course, you know, we all have these anxieties about what other people think of us, but she had made something out of a casual remark that was so, you know, it was just an offhand statement. He said, well, I don't think that's a good idea. Let's try this idea. But she just was ready to pack her bags and leave New Jersey and go back to her job, you know, as a barista in Milwaukee, you know. So, you know, the thing is, everything was riding on this person giving her an approving word or an approving look. And unless this person gave her an approving word or an approving look, she felt utterly devastated. And you know, there are so many people in our society who are like this. You know, maybe we all are to some extent. You know, we're told when we're, you know, my father was a really unhappy guy, right? And he was stymied in his job. He wanted to be like an officer, senior officer in the Navy. You know, he made a certain rank, officer rank, but he wanted to be like in the upper echelons of the Navy, and he never made it. And he was so unhappy, he was so down on himself. I remember once that on the base where we were stationed, the commander of the base, who was a commander, you know, that was his rank. He flew in, and my father, when he met him, I had never seen my father suck up before, you know, and I don't mean this in a negative way. My father was practically falling over himself to please this man. And I was like a kid, I was like 10. And I looked at my father falling over himself, trying to get this man to love him, right? Give me the love, you know? And I was embarrassed. I was actually like, a child could see it. And it was a side of my father that I'd never seen, you know? And my father was a deeply insecure person, right? You know, like all of us in a certain way, like me too. You know? And, but my father had such low self-esteem, you know, he felt like such a loser all the time. And he probably thought that was him, you know, that was his issue, you know, because he looked around and he saw people who seemed to be very self-confident. The woman who came into my office and sobbed because of the professor who said something negative about her thinking, I know that professor, you know, I know that guy. And, you know, I actually know he feels inferior too. You know, actually, I know him very well. And he's a nice guy. But, you know, he feels like his career has stalled out because he publishes things that nobody reads, right? He'll publish an article and he'll wait for the feedback, and it's just like the sound of crickets, right? You know, and lots of people are like that. You know, they write, you know, journalists, you write things in your, oh, book writers, you know, you write your book, you're waiting for it to sail to the top of the New York Times bestseller list, and, you know, maybe it gets remaindered in a year, right? So, you know, this professor was well known and respected, but he felt like everybody else had gone forward and he was stuck, right? So, you know, the graduate student sobbing because Professor X didn't give her strokes, you know, positive feedback. And Professor X is having lunch with me and telling me about how upset he is because this book came out in his field and he's not cited in the work cited, you know. I have a friend in publishing, and she says that, you know, being an author is miserable because, you know, when you're writing your book, the whole time you're writing your book, you're thinking, can I ever finish this book? And when you finish the book, you realize it's not as good a book as you had hoped, right? You know, no writer is ever happy with his book or her book. And then your big terror is that you won't be able to find a book agent. And so then you look for a book agent, and, you know, I have a friend of mine who's written a book and he publishes lots of stuff, and he can't find a book agent for his book. And he's been trying to find a book agent for years. It's like, he's a genius, I would say. He works on technology, and he publishes articles that get really well discussed and are, you know, famous, you know, but he can't publish his book. Nobody wants to publish. I don't know why. I read the book and I thought it was great. No, I don't know why. So he can't find a book agent. So, you know, so you write your book and maybe you can't finish your book, but if you manage to finish your book, you're miserable most of the time. And then when you get it done, you look at your book and you say, this is not the book I meant to write. You know, this is really not as good as I dreamed of. Then you look for a book agent. But if you get a book agent, you might not get the book agent you wanted, right? And then you get a book agent. And then the book is published, but it's not with the press you really wanted. And then it's, you know, comes out and you hope to be on the bestseller list, but you're not. You know? So my friend said, every stage in the process of becoming an author is like unhappiness. And it's unhappiness because we're trapped in a system that's giving us so much bad advice. It's giving us so much bad advice all the time. You know, and it makes everybody feel like a loser, right? Everybody feels like a loser. Even the quote unquote winners feel like a loser. The system's values are not healthy. We don't live in a healthy culture. I don't have to tell you that that's true because we can see it everywhere. But we have internalized these messages forever, since we were, you know, little children. My father, just to go back to my father, you know, my father felt so like a flop. He felt like a big flop. And he used to tell me, he'd say, you've got to be a winner in this world. He'd say, there's no room for the losers. Right? And I was like, you know, six or something. But this idea that, you know, there's winners and there's losers. And he used to say, there's no room for number two in this world. You know, my father must have felt like he was number two or number 10 or something. He said, there's no room for number two in this world. You know, and that's a terrible message to give kids, I would say. But the thing is, you know, I absorbed that and I didn't ever think about it until I was an adult. And I was reading something and I thought, did my father really say that? You know? But we take in all of these unhealthy messages and they affect us in every way. You know, actually, in Lin Ji's time, China was like this. You know, in China, there were basically two classes of people. There were the mandarins and there were the peasants, right? And if you were a peasant, you were a peasant, right? You know, basically you had... your job was a life of toil, right? You know, basically you got up and you planted rice and you had to pay taxes on your rice, you know, and it was a life of, you know, very modest life, you know, there were no vacations for peasants don't get vacations. They don't go on trips. You know, it's just like, basically it's toil. And then you could be a mandarin. And if you were a mandarin, you were a government bureaucrat. And all the wealth, all the freedom, literacy came from being a mandarin. And if you were poor, you stood no chance of getting to be a mandarin. There's just no chance. And if your family could scrape together the money, they would scrape together the money to give your one son in the family a good education. And the son would have a shot at becoming a mandarin. And if the son could become a mandarin, the son could, you know, start making money and contacts. And that could all turn into like business connections and things. And the wealth would start flowing into the family. And little by little, the family could get out of being peasants, right? So this is kind of oversimplified, but everybody wanted to get into the Mandarin ranks, and you had to study. And there was an annual exam where you'd go and you'd be locked in a little house. There were actually like examination little huts, and you'd be given your job and you'd have to write, recall all this poetry and history. And you'd have to be able to write with your beautiful calligraphy with your brushes. And only like 1% passed the exam. So almost everybody failed the exam and went home feeling like, oh, my My whole family has invested every penny in my success and I have failed. And by the way, Zen masters, so many Zen masters had failed the imperial exam, right? That's a fact. You know, lots of Zen masters had failed the imperial exam. So almost everybody in China felt like crap about themselves, right? And of course, the aristocrats, the mandarins, the bureaucrats, they were all fighting each other to get to the very top, right? So actually, the mandarins had different outfits. If you had a certain emblem on your robe, you were at this rank. And if you had another emblem, you had this rank. And if you had this, you know, finally, there's like the highest rank. It's like the phoenix, or I think it was, or the dragon, right? You know, that's like the highest rank. So they were unhappy too. So Lin Ji comes along and he says, "This is terrible. This is a terrible system. It's cruel, and everybody lives in darkness of forgetting who they are. Every morning we recite these words, Atta Dipa Viharata Atta Sarana Anana Sarana Atta Dipa. You are the light. You are the light. You are the light. There is no other light." So Lin Ji says, "You are the light. Don't listen to these people who don't even like themselves. Don't listen to these people. You are the light. You are Buddha nature is your nature. Buddha nature is your nature." And he says, "Don't live this way. Don't live this way. Don't fight for the scraps of identity. You know, it's like fighting for pennies when you have gold in your pocket, right? You are the light. Don't let them do this to you. Don't live like this. Right? You are the light. You treat yourself like the light. Treat and cultivate the light in yourself." This is what Lin Ji was trying to tell people. This is, when he says a true person, he says, in you, there is a person of no rank. See, the person of no rank means not an admiral, not a captain, not a lieutenant, right? Not a CEO, not a CFO, you know, not a branch chief. Those are not real. Those are not real. Not professor, associate professor, lecturer one. That's not real. Those are phantoms, fantasies, and they keep us in darkness. You know, he's not saying quit your job tomorrow, right? But he is saying we live the wrong way. Our values are wrong, wrong, wrong. And we know they're wrong because we feel badly about ourselves all the time. And that leads to corrosive behaviors and exploitation of one another, greed, anger, and delusion. You know, the way out of this is to get into contact with the light in ourselves. And when we recognize the light in ourselves, we can see the light in others. So Lin Ji says to the assembly, there is a true person of no rank. See, no rank. The ranks are illusion. You know, there's a true person of no rank who goes in and out of the portals of your face, who goes in and out with your breath. That's the light. You know, in you is the light. It goes in and out through the portals of your breath. Now, the thing is, this last part of the koan is a little puzzling, right? He said this, and then this guy comes up and says, well, what is this person of no rank? And Lin Ji gets down and slaps him and says, what a piece of dry crap this person of no rank is. And that's sort of puzzling, like, what's that all about? We find that person of no rank, that luminous mind, this luminous mind in ourselves. First, we have to learn how to enter deep samadhi. Then we have to enter mushin. And then, we get to that calm and beautiful place, but then we actually have to encounter our obstacles. You know, that's how we wake, that's how we find a person of no rank. You know, we sit down on the cushion and we want to be the Buddha, but, you know, we suddenly realize, you know, on the cushion that we feel a lot of anger or we feel a lot of envy, you know. I mean, I actually, yesterday I talked about the fact that in my life I've had anger issues, but I've also had envy issues, you know. I mean, sometimes I'll read something somebody, a colleague has written in my field, and I'll think, I'll be mad at him. And then I'll realize, why am I mad at him? It's because I like what he did. I wish I'd done it. You know, I'm envious, right? Envy. So, you know, the way to get to that luminous Buddha nature is to work through our obstacles, as we're doing here at Sesshin. You know, if we don't trust that the Buddha nature is there, we'll never work through our obstacles because we'll be afraid that the obstacles are all that we are. You know, so one of the reasons people don't know themselves very well or trust themselves is because they're afraid that there's nothing there except my anger, or there's nothing there except my envy, or there's nothing there except my lust or hatred, right? And so people don't investigate. They don't work through their obstacles. They don't even want to see their obstacles, right? But if we have confidence that on the other side of our illusions, there's Buddha nature, you know, then we have the courage to work through them. And every time we work through them, we realize again our Buddha nature. You know, I can remember working on a koan, and I was so, you know, koans don't always make you happy. You know, sometimes you're working on a koan and it really eats you up. You know, I can remember just throwing something across the room. And I didn't know why. There was just this real unhappiness or tension. And, you know, then suddenly it hit me, you know, that I suddenly realized, you know, something. And it was like the sky opened up and I just felt so happy and at ease. You know, and this is sort of the rhythm of Zen practice, right? Where, you know, we encounter something in ourselves that we didn't know was there, you know, and then we work it through, and it's hard work, you know. It's hard work to liberate yourself. It's work, you know. You sit down on the cushion and you have pain in your legs and you're tired, but, you know, then there's this koan and And, you know, you lose faith in yourself, you feel blocked, etc. You know, but eventually, you know, your big mind, that luminous Buddha nature, helps you out. You know, you just step back and let it lead you, let it lead you. And it leads you through this dark place, you know, and you come out on the other side and it's such a big world, it's such a beautiful world. And you keep doing that, And eventually, you know, you see, you know, I am the light, you know, or the light is what I really am, is another way to put it. The light is what I really am, you know. It's not as Kurt, but, you know, the light is, I'm not Kurt, you know. Kurt is a name that my parents gave me. But, you know, fundamentally, I am the light. Fundamentally, you are the light. So please, please cultivate your Buddha nature today. Taking a thief for one's son, taking the servant for the master. See, that's ordinary life. So fucked up, right? Ordinary life is so, the values of our society are so wrong, right? Taking a thief for one's son. We can't distinguish between a thief and our own son. We can't distinguish the servant from the master. You know, we don't know the difference between a wooden ladle and my father's skull, right? A donkey saddle rim is not your father's jawbone, right? You know, in other words, we don't know our asses from a hole in the ground, as we say. When breaking earth, separating roots, how do you discern the master? Where do we find something of real value? Linji said to the assembly, there is a true man of no rank always going in and out through the portals of your face. Beginners who have not yet found it, look. That's practice, right? Then a monk came forward and said, what is the true man of no rank? So he's not looking at himself. He's asking somebody in authority, right? He doesn't trust the process. He doesn't trust himself. He's asking Linji. And Linji got down from the seat, grabbed and held him. The monk hesitated. Linji grabs him and looks at him. Don't you get it? The monk doesn't get it. Linji pushed him away and says, the true man of no rank, what a piece of dry crap he is. He's really saying there, if you hold on to this as an idea, it doesn't liberate you. You have to find it. You have to find it through what we're doing at Sesshin. Delusion and enlightenment are opposite. They're not the same. Delusion and enlightenment are not are opposite. Subtly communicated with simplicity. Spring opens the 100 flowers in one puff. Power pulls back 9 bulls in one yank. If you can harness that energy, you can pull 9 bulls back with one yank. To all intents and purposes, it looks hopeless. It looks hopeless. You know, there's so much crap, we'll never clear it away. But, you know, it's like there's a sweet spring under all these rushes, and it will suddenly birth. What if it suddenly bursts forth, freely flowing? That's working through our obstacles. So let's keep up the good work.